You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferrack. Coming up, kids make so much artwork at school and at home. Deciding what's worth hanging on to as a memento and what can be tossed out seems like a tough decision sometimes. We find out why our guest says we should feel no guilt about throwing most of it away. First, Republican U.S. Senate candidate Leah Vukmir has been ramping up attacks on Senator Tammy Baldwin for her role in the scandal at the Veterans Affairs Hospital in Tomah. The original wrongdoing involved the overprescription of opioids that resulted in the deaths of at least two patients, including a Marine. Republicans say that Baldwin failed to act on the problems in 2015 after her office received whistleblower complaints. Baldwin later fired a high-level staffer over the matter. Baldwin later co-sponsored legislation that toughened opioid prescription guidelines. She's also accusing Vukmir of politicizing veterans issues. Jesse Apoyan is a political reporter at the Capital Times. Jesse, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, take us back to the beginning of this story and what was going on in Tomah.
Well, I mean, this goes back years and years and years, really, even as early as 2011, if not earlier than that. That was the first time, I believe, to my knowledge, that anyone in Congress, and that was Congressman Ron Kind, received an anonymous letter raising concerns about opioid overprescription at the Tomah VA. At that point, the letter was sent to the VA Inspector General, an investigation was launched, and for the next few years, Congress was waiting for that investigation to come back. It found that among the 3,000 prescribers at VA medical centers in the Midwestern region, three prescribers at the Tomah VA were in the top 10 in opioid prescriptions during this time. It also found that some employees had left in the years surrounding that investigation because they were concerned with the rate of opioid prescriptions. But the report also didn't determine that there was any criminal wrongdoing or any sort of willful neglect. So there wasn't anything released in public at that point. And the matter kind of lie for a little while until Tammy Baldwin heard later that year in 2014 from a constituent who had some concerns about the issue.
Right. And let's fast forward to today for a moment. We'll get back into some of those details. What is the Vukmir campaign and along with other Republicans saying about what Senator Baldwin and her office got wrong?
What they're saying is that she essentially sat on a report, or that her office didn't act quickly enough on this report. So she did receive this report, or at least her office did. It's sort of unclear still exactly what the chain of receipt and command was on that. But she was given the report. She gave this report to a constituent, and later around that time was when this Marine veteran died of an overdose, which you mentioned earlier. A few months later, there was a whistleblower who was working at the Tomah VA who started contacting members of Congress across the board from Wisconsin, talking about some of these same problems. So what Leah Vukmir and other Republicans are saying is that Baldwin's office mishandled the whistleblower complaints. And Baldwin's said basically as much as that. She actually ended up conducting and having an outside investigation conducted within her staff to determine where things went wrong. What she said at the end of this was that there are a lot of mistakes made really at every level in her staff and in her office, but she didn't believe that anyone had done so willfully or that anyone was sort of acting malevolently in this. But Republicans are arguing that she should have acted much more quickly on this, that, you know, the buck stops with her on this issue.
How has the Baldwin campaign reacted to these attacks now over this issue?
Well, they certainly bring up the law that you mentioned, Jason's Law, which basically strengthens prescribing requirements, and dealing with Center for Disease Control guidelines for opioid prescriptions, and that was passed in 2016 with cooperation with Jason Kokoski's family. This is the Marine who did die of an overdose at Tomah VA. So she talks about that, and she points to veterans who support her and says that she's owned up to her mistakes and she's tried to do better and made sure that her office wouldn't make the same mistake again, and that Republicans are politicizing the issue.
Talking to Jesse O'Ployan, political reporter at the Capital Times, looking at the U.S. Senate race here in Wisconsin between Leah Vukmir and incumbent Tammy Baldwin, and the issue of the Toma VA hospital that's come up in this race. Jesse, you mentioned candidate Baldwin, Senator Baldwin, appearing with veterans. Leah Vukmir doing the same. Both seem to be trying to highlight the support from veterans whenever they can.
Yeah, absolutely. And we even saw this a little bit in the 2016 Senate race between Russ Feingold and Ron Johnson. And each of them even tried to make this an issue also. So, you know, this hasn't come out of nowhere. And in that case, we saw something similar where it was sort of each side trying to highlight the support that they had among veterans. And it turns out veterans, like most other people, are not uniformly behind any one particular party. So each candidate can probably find some support among people who have served in the military.
We've seen this new Marquette University Law School poll this week showing Tammy Baldwin with a 53-42% lead over Leah Vukmir. That's up from a 2-point percentage lead a month ago. Qualifying that, the race is still has a while to go. Obviously, sometimes polls in Wisconsin don't always match up with the outcome. But do you think this Toma issue is going to be one of Leah Vukmir's main strategies to try to overcome what looks like now like a big gap?
I do. I think, you know, this is something that crosses party lines. This is an issue that resonates across the aisle. And, you know, I've talked to Republicans who basically say, you know, they're not going to win by reminding people that a Democrat is liberal. So they need to point to, you know, more specific things and more specific issues. And this is certainly the highest profile negative knock on Tammy Baldwin during her last few years in office.
And in your reporting on this, you point out that a lot of Senator Baldwin's campaign attacks on Leah Vukmir center around the issue of health care. What are we seeing there?
What we're seeing there is twofold, really. One message we're hearing in the governor's race, too, and that's the issue of pre-existing conditions of, well, you know, Republicans who have opposed the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. Democrats like Tammy Baldwin will argue that if successful in undoing that law, people who are, you know, covered who have pre-existing conditions would be in jeopardy of continuing that coverage. The other thing that Tammy Baldwin's campaign is really highlighting on the healthcare issue is a series of votes that Leah Vukmir took as a state legislator dealing with insurance mandates. So one in particular was a bill that would require insurers in Wisconsin to cover oral chemotherapy if they also covered intravenous chemotherapy. Leah Vukmir voted against that bill. She opposed imposing mandates on insurers, but she was really in the minority, not just in the legislature, but even in her own party on voting against that one.
And then how's the Vukmir campaign responded to that line of attack?
They say basically the same thing that Scott Walker has said when Tony Evers has brought it up, and that's that she does oppose the Affordable Care Act, but she does believe in covering people with pre-existing conditions, and she believes that both can be done.
Now, I'm seeing on Twitter today, it's happening now that one, either the candidate or their campaign is posting stuff, and the other campaign is responding to it right away. We're seeing back and forth now, even on social media. These two issues, the Toma VA and the healthcare issues, we're going to be seeing a lot more of this, do you think, between now and November?
I think so. I think, you know, you're going to see Tammy Baldwin bringing up healthcare a lot. You're going to see Leah Vukmir bringing up the Toma VA a lot. And I think the healthcare issue, we're going to see just as much in the governor's race, too. And as you mentioned, campaigns and candidates are more and more prone to carrying these arguments out over Twitter, which is a lot more fast moving than the old days of the press release at the press conference. But here we are.
We'll leave it there. Jesse, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Jesse O'Ployan is a political reporter at the Capital Times. We talked with her about the U.S. Senate race between Tammy Baldwin and Leah Vukmir and a couple of the key back and forth issues, including the Toma VA scandal and health care. We encourage our kids to make art. Give them crayons at an early age, coloring books, paint, whatever. They make it at school, at home. It seems natural to encourage them to create stuff. But what seems less natural is the decision of what to do with all their creations. The pile can grow really fast. How do you decide what's worthy of saving and what should go? How do you throw things away without feeling guilty? You could join in at 800-642-1234 if you're a parent. Are you or have you saved some of your child's art? If so, what have you done with it? Did your own parents save your artwork and give it to you as an adult? What did you think? Call 800-642-1234. Mary Townsend is an assistant professor of philosophy at St. John's University. She's the author of a book on Plato called The Woman Question in Plato's Republic. Her recent piece for The Atlantic is called Throw Your Children's Art Away. Mary, welcome to Central Time.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Well, this has been a quandary for me as a parent for lots of years. I go back and forth between I have to save every precious little thing and then I'm a ruthless monster and I throw lots away. What are your main points in thinking about, maybe we don't need to keep the artifacts that they've created?
Well, I think, first of all, my only advice to parents would be you have to do what you feel is right. And I wouldn't say throw it out all. but I think that there's an almost a moral relief that when we realize that we can get rid of some, and we can get rid of a fair amount, because we might not even actually want our own childhood art ourselves. And we have a lot of mementos of our children and of our parents. And I think we can make decisions about what we want to save and what we want to keep.
And you write that the important thing here isn't the completed artwork. It's the fact that they did something. That's the important moment.
Yeah, I think both like the making and the product are important. But I think for children, and especially children who don't seem to be prodigies at art, I think it's all right that they can enjoy making something even if they're not very good at it, in the classic Mr. Rogers phrase. But that doesn't mean that we have the same obligation to the material that's left over when they're finished making that art.
In some ways, you write, it maybe is more respecting their creativity and their art to not keep that, I think you use the word ephemeral piece of art.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that there's something about what they do that is very free and very playful. But it doesn't sustain itself necessarily as the kind of art that we want to keep around forever. And then it can become a burden. And if you've cleaned out the house of an older relative, I think you felt that feeling before.
You write that you were on the receiving end. I think your mother and others are doing some cleaning house, and they gave you boxes of childhood mementos. What was it like as a grown-up to experience some of those things you'd created as a kid?
Well, at first I was sort of horrified because I'm talking about like 10 boxes.
Oh, wow.
Coming in. I don't know about the rest of y'all, but I have never had much closet space. So it really was a question of what do we save and what do we keep? And I think I found as soon as I opened the box that I was a little terrified because most of these memories weren't memories for me. They weren't something that had remained as important to me. And I think that I was sort of overwhelmed by the lost time of childhood. And so it seemed to me, I have memories of my childhood. I have certain things that I've saved that remind me of my relationship with my parents, and I have relationships with my own children. But boy, it doesn't have to be 10 boxes worth.
Yeah, how would you curate maybe a little more effectively saving, I don't know, representative samples and not the whole 10 boxes?
Yeah, I think samples are good. I don't know, my mother actually has a wall of samples of various artworks, and my feeling for them is like pride, but also embarrassed pride, just because they weren't that good, and I love that she cherished them, but I cherish the relationship more than I cherish like the actual possession, if that makes sense.
Sure, I had a similar experience. My folks had saved for some reason this big box of letters I'd received back in the day when kids wrote letters, I guess, and talk about ephemeral, going through them and seeing what I had written and what had been written back to me. Some people, when you read biographies, there's this really profound correspondence they have. This was not that. I was embarrassed that it still existed in some way. Do you think that's a common experience for kids' creative process as well?
I think so, and I think that can actually be healthy in that, you want to grow up to be a writer. I think that some things from your early writing are maybe just not worth it. It's all right to have a moment in your life where everything you did wasn't like live or die moment.
We're talking to Mary Townsend, assistant professor of philosophy at St. John's University, about her piece in The Atlantic. It's called Throw Your Children's Art Away. She says we don't need to save all of the things our kids create, even if we feel attached to it or feel terrible if we get rid of it. Let's go to one of our callers at 800-642-1234. Samantha is with us in Green Bay. Samantha, hi.
Hello.
What'd you want to tell us about?
Well, I am an elementary school art teacher, and I found out about a wonderful app that I use. The students can take pictures of their art right when they're finished with it, right in class. And it actually emails the parents, gives them a digital copy of their artwork, and it kind of keeps a really nicely organized track record of their progress. And their artwork is all digitized in a portfolio that way. So kind of eliminates the need to stockpile up on all of those projects.
Samantha, I want to ask you, as an art teacher, do you see your students, you know, wanting to go back and look at that thing they created at the beginning of the year, or are they ready to do it and forget about it and move on?
I'm just starting out, actually, so I haven't had a lot of experience with them wanting to revisit things of the past, but they are always very anxious to bring them home and show their families. So I think there is still that element of having the physical copy, but just kind of having a place to keep it safe, and then also being able to kind of let go of some as well.
Samantha, thanks a lot for calling in. And what do you think, Mary, this idea of digitizing our kids' artwork?
It seems like a good idea. I mean, it's we've talked a lot about guilt, and I know that it's never an easy thing, even if the child themselves is not interested anymore. Like, you feel like you ought to do something, like you need to, like, preserve something. It seems like the digital could help us with that guilt. I know for myself, I try to remember things, but pictures aren't always the most helpful thing for me to remember. So I wonder whether this would be a good aid. Would it satisfy the kind of memory that we're looking for?
Samantha, thanks for sharing that. We'll go to Sarah with us in Madison. Sarah, hello.
Hi. I have been married for about 20 years, and my mother-in-law still gives me my husband's childhood projects every time she cleans out another closet. And it took about 10 years for me, into our marriage, for me to be able to throw it away without feeling like I was hurting my husband's feelings.
Now, is she giving you a beloved treasure gift, or is she trying to embarrass your husband here?
No, I think that she cherished these items, but there was a leaf report with these desiccated, dried up leaves that were kind of falling off of the pages, and a coffee pin with yarn glued around it that was kind of falling off.
Sarah, thank you so much for sharing that with us. Yeah, Mary, Sarah's maybe making the case you're making here. Not all of that needed to be saved and passed on.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny. It's like, I find it's hard to throw away something that someone you love has made, but it's almost worse when, like, it's your husband or yourself, because the saver sort of, you felt like, well, this person saved it, you know, like, it must have been important. And so you sort of almost, like, put it off, throwing it away, like, it's harder. So that, I don't know. It seems like we're all trying to save it for each other, but who is taking the lasting pleasure from it?
I want to go next to Valerie in Muscadet. Valerie, hello.
I have to be the contrarian here. I'm 60. I'm a professional artist. I have one drawing from my entire childhood. I was the youngest of four. By the time they got to me, there's hardly any photos. There's hardly anything left that I ever did. So, you know, I would have appreciated something, like a box or something, one box. I got nothing.
Valerie, thanks for sharing that. And yeah, maybe that's at the heart of some parents' fears if they don't get rid of stuff. Well, maybe I've got the next Georgia O'Keeffe growing up here, and this stuff's going to be, you know, important in tracing their development in the future. What do you think, Mary?
No, this is the hardest argument, because I think real artists, and this is true of any kind of art, whether it's music, whether it's writing, poetry, real artists like want to see and trace their development. I guess if I myself were an artist, I'd have a better sense of where my kid was and, like, where their interests lie, and so I can make a decision based on that. I guess I would look myself for, like, where their talents and their desires seem to be, and then sort of use that information to make decisions about what I save and what I keep.
Valerie, thanks a lot for calling in. We have time for another caller. Jason is with us in Madison. Jason, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. You know, I absolutely love this topic, and I had to chuckle when I first heard you bring it up, because as we have two children, and my wife and I tend to bury the artwork as far down into the trash as we possibly can, so that when they open it up, they don't see it, and then kind of have a fit that we threw it away. And, you know, what we've found works out is we have them each pick one or two items from the school year that we can keep, and it keeps it into one tote. So now with each child, we have one tote each that they have just a few different pieces of artwork, and it's kind of meaningful, and they like to look back to when they were 5 or 6, even now that they're 11 and 9. So that's worked out for me pretty good, but I appreciate the topic.
Fun. Jason, thanks for sharing that. What do you think of that, Mary, letting the kid curate, pick out a few, a small percentage to keep, and then maybe subtly burying the rest?
You know, I've actually heard from several people who have a similar strategy, and it seems to work really well, especially in involving the child. One parent was telling me about a special frame she bought that could only hold 50 pieces of art, and the child themselves picks what goes in next. And then another family would vote on one picture of art per frame for each child, and that one piece of art would rotate. So I think there's a couple of different strategies that could keep preserve the material, but also curate as well.
Do you think it's valuable for a kid to learn that, you know, it's okay to throw away or maybe recycle some of this? The important thing was that they did it, not in what they took home with it.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that it helps them sort of think about their progress as an artist or as a writer or as a musician in a way that's, like, not too terrifying, but just sort of like, well, you know, it's practical. We need to keep something. What do you, child, think we should keep?
It's been a lot of fun, Mary. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Mary Townsend is an assistant professor of philosophy at St. John's University. She joined us to talk about what to do with all the art that kids make. Her recent piece for The Atlantic is called Throw Your Children's Art Away. Most of it, anyway. Going forward, at least for now, nonprofit groups that give money to political campaigns have to disclose the names of many of their donors. This week, the U.S. Supreme Court refused to block a lower court's ruling issuing that requirement. That means if you give at least $200 a year to a political nonprofit organization, people can find out about it. Advocates for stricter regulation of money in politics applauded the move, saying we're about to learn a lot more about who's funding elections. Conservatives say the change raises First Amendment concerns about donor privacy. Michelle Yeehy Lee is a reporter on the Washington Post's National Political Enterprise and Accountability Team. She covers money and influence in politics. Michelle, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, there's a lot of different kinds of political groups that are involved in campaigns. What type of group does this ruling, or I guess this non-ruling, affect?
This affects politically active nonprofit groups, which are often called dark money groups by their critics. These are nonprofits that participate in some political activity, but that activity only makes up to 50% of what they do. So because it doesn't comprise more than 50%, they don't have to report all of their donors. And now all of that is about to change.
Right. Why did they originally not have to reveal their donors? And what was the case that has turned that around?
So in the past, they didn't have to disclose their donors unless it was a very specific fundraising circumstance, which rarely happened. So basically, unless they asked donors to pay for a specific ad that was going to run at a specific time calling for the election or defeat of a specific federal candidate, they didn't have to disclose their donors. And the donors and solicitations don't get into that specific of a circumstance. So they were able to not report the donors by asking generally for them to support their political activities. But now, the rule that they had been participating under, which had been in place for almost 40 years, is gone. That's what the lower court ruling did. The federal judge threw out that rule, and the Supreme Court decided not to question that for now. So the groups may have to report a lot more donors than they previously had to, and they're now trying to figure out exactly which donors they have to reveal.
Right. Does this apply to somebody who made a donation, I don't know, 2 months ago in this election cycle, to people who make donations between now and November?
So that's actually in question right now. It's not entirely clear. Part of the lawsuit involved disclosing donors who had given to these groups for the past year, for the past calendar year. So there are some people who say that this decision should be applied retroactively, but a lot of people are fighting against that and saying that it should only happen moving forward. So the Federal Election Commission's chairwoman, for what it's worth, has said that she does not think that this should be applied retroactively and that it should only apply moving forward. So we'll see if the guidance from the FEC actually follows where she stands.
Still a lot up in the air. Michelle, thanks for bringing us up to date.
Thank you.
That's Michelle Yeehee Lee, a reporter on the Washington Post National Political Enterprise and Accountability Team. She covers money and influence in politics. We've got the basics of the story now. How could this affect the upcoming fall midterms and future elections? Eleanor Neff Powell is an associate professor of political science at UW-Madison. She studies Congress, political parties, and money in politics. Ellie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, can you talk about how important these kinds of groups we're talking about, as we just heard, are in the overall political landscape?
So these nonprofit groups have been spending a lot over the past election cycles. They've been increasingly using this tool to avoid disclosure. And so groups like Crosswords GPS, the group that's been involved with the current lawsuit, you know, in past years has spent, you know, around $100 million per election cycle. And there are a number of other groups that have also spent a similarly large amounts of money.
Now, we hear a lot about PACs or political action committees. This is not them.
This is not them. This is a group, this is a type of group, these nonprofits, that didn't typically have to disclose their donors. PACs do have to disclose their donors. And so this is sort of one of the biggest areas of dark money in campaign finance that's now potentially going to have to disclose.
Right. If I wanted to put a lot of money into politics but didn't necessarily want my name attached to it, this was a type of group, the type of group I would go after?
This was one of the biggest vehicles for that sort of thing. Mm-hmm.
And do we have a sense of the scope of how much money was involved in this, or because of these reporting and disclosure exemptions, do we not know that?
It's a little difficult to say. I mean, certainly in the order of magnitude in terms of hundreds of millions of dollars, these types of groups, but it's tough to say more precisely than that.
So let's talk about some of the pros and cons here. The group Crew Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, I believe they were part of this lawsuit. They're saying this is great. It provides disclosure. It allows us to follow the money and the influence. Can you talk about that case?
Yeah, so the larger context behind the case is this idea that this wasn't originally the intent of these nonprofits, that essentially the argument is that this is a sort of distortion of campaign finance rules and that there shouldn't be this end run around the system where you can sort of contribute to campaigns without having your name disclosed. There's this idea that there should be sort of sunshine and disclosure, that that's sort of important for voters to know where the money is coming from.
And so this kind of nonprofit might have been, I have a group, we're advocating for an issue, we want to do a little bit of involvement in political campaigns, but we don't exist for that main purpose.
Exactly. So these groups are sort of by law not supposed to do more than 50% of their activities supposed to be political. So theoretically, they're supposed to have some other majority purpose, but it can be sort of up to the 50% they can spend on campaign finance.
Now, does political only mean an ad that says vote for this candidate or vote against that candidate? They wouldn't include an ad that says this issue is important, call such and such a candidate, but doesn't use the words vote for?
You get into a real gray area there about sort of when candidate's being advocated for or against, sort of where it's political and where it's sort of more sort of issue oriented and sort of less political. So there's a bit of gray area here in terms of how we classify that sort of middle section of ads.
In the reaction to this case and in other campaign finance issues, the argument against disclosure is often along the lines of people should be free to participate in politics, donate money, and not risk different forms of retaliation or harassment for having their names attached to the donation. Has that been an argument that's been around for a while?
Yeah, that's sort of one argument against disclosure, is that essentially people should be allowed to exercise their free speech to support candidates or causes that they support from. They should be able to do it free of harassment or free of sort of damage to their business. You know, sometimes you get consumer backlash if you're a company or a company owner that contributes and that your consumers don't like that issue.
And these new guidelines, after this case now, it doesn't apply to all donors. If I donate $50 or $199 to Group X, they don't have to disclose my name. 200 plus in the course of a year, they do.
Exactly. Only if you're giving more than 200 plus in the course of a year. And that's true actually for most campaign contributions, not just for these campaign contributions to nonprofits, but typically contributions less than $200. It's sort of up to the campaign itself whether or not they disclose those names or not. They're sort of considered such small contributions. They're not of concern to sort of the democratic process.
So under the current state of affairs, after the Supreme Court said we're not going to block this order, these nonprofit groups are sounds like playing under similar rules to, as you mentioned, political action committees or a candidate's campaign itself, where they disclose donors in a similar way. Is that right?
Yes. Now, it's worth noting that this in some ways might be a temporary state of affairs, that essentially what we have on the court right now with Justice Kennedy's vacancy and with Judge Kavanaugh not yet confirmed, we have a 4-4 court. And so this was just a sort of, they didn't intervene in sort of an emergency order to stop the lower court's ruling, but they could still later take the case. And so if we had a conservative justice on the court who's confirmed at some later date, this the court could still take the case, and so they could overturn this ruling. So we're in sort of a little bit of a gray area here because we have this tied situation on the court.
Yeah, looking back at recent major Supreme Court rulings on campaign finance issues, Citizens United, McCutcheon, if, as you say, there were another conservative justice on the court, would you anticipate more moves in that direction, including on a case like this?
Yes, it's again, any case, anything can happen. But the pattern that we've seen on the court is that there are sort of the four more liberal justices tend to be in favor of disclosure, and the four more conservative justices tend to be sort of opposed to that. So if we add another conservative justice, presumably they would overturn this decision.
On a practical level, if this law sticks, or if this ruling sticks for a while, do you think it'll have an effect on who's donating to what?
It might potentially discourage donors. You know, another potential argument is it might change how voters view these ads if they know who's supporting them. It's potentially, you know, if it turns out that, you know, some of these groups, the money's coming from some very well-known donors or sort of causes that the people that the voters don't like, you know, potentially that could change how they view the ads. Maybe they're less likely to take the information in the ad as seriously if they think that the information might be tainted or biased in some way.
We're talking about the U.S. Supreme Court's refusal to block a lower court's ruling that nonprofit political groups disclose some of their donors over $200 a year. Ellie Neff Powell is with us, associate professor of political science at UW-Madison. What do you think? You can join us at 800-642-1234. Do you think we need to know who's funding election ads, election groups, these nonprofit groups, or for that matter, PACs or candidates? Do you think disclosure is important, or should there be ways that donors can make anonymous donations that enter into political campaigns that call on us to vote for or against a candidate? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you coming up on Central Time. We continue our discussion on the new disclosure rules for nonprofit political groups. Eleanor Neff Powell is an associate professor of political science at UW-Madison. She follows Congress, political parties, and money in politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this non-ruling from the Supreme Court saying, yeah, these nonprofit political groups have to disclose who their donors are, at least donors over a certain amount? Do you think it chills speech if people have to say who they are when they donate, if that information has to be revealed? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. To your calls now, Cindy is with us in Appleton. Cindy, hello.
Hello.
What do you think?
I think this is just a total hypocritical double standard. I mean, you've got people that are going to have to give, you know, if they give $200, they're going to have to disclose. And then you've got people that are giving $2 million dark money and they don't have to disclose. That just is not right.
So you're happy to see the disclosure requirement, it sounds like?
Well, if it's fair, but if you're going to make people that are giving $200 disclose and people that are giving $2 million don't have to, that's not fair.
Gotcha. Cindy, thanks for the call. $200 and up in donations to these groups. So if you donate $200 or $2 million, they disclose the name and the amount? Is that?
Yes, the name and the amount. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so both. So any amount over $200, both the really high-dollar donors and these sort of mid-level donors, the $200 donors, are all going to have to disclose under these rules.
A question I imagine we don't know the answer to with these political nonprofits is the amounts of donations they get, since until now they haven't had to disclose. We don't know how many of their donations are small or large.
Yes, there's a lot of ambiguity and uncertainty to sort of understand exactly what's been happening here. So one of the things, as sort of people who study money in politics, we want to know these questions to be able to understand what's been happening in the last few election cycles and what's happening going forward.
Thanks for that call. We'll go next to Jay on the line in Madison. Jay, hi.
Hey, hi. Thanks for covering the subject. It's an important one. I do think that most Wisconsinites favor disclosure of the donors. After all, these people are trying to influence the outcome of an election, and you know, I think to have complete information, people need to know who's behind these nasty ads that run on television and radio, not national public radio, of course, but others. And so disclosure, I think, is in everyone's interest, and even the United States Supreme Court, even those who favored Citizens United, said that disclosure is almost essential. The question I have is that my understanding of this ruling is that it only applies to federal elections. So in other words, the very nasty gubernatorial race that's occurring right now in Wisconsin between Tony Evers and Scott Walker features a lot of these nasty ads run by outside special interest groups. Disclosure, my understanding is, would not be these outside groups running in the state elections would not be required to disclose. And then the second thing, and then I'll get off the air, is that wouldn't it be possible for the groups that now are running these campaign ads and don't disclose, and these are ads that basically do say, Rob, as you mentioned, vote for, vote against, but had not been disclosed, all they'd have to do is start running the phony issue ads, the sham issue ads.
Gotcha, Jay. You gave us a lot there. I want to get into both of those issues. This ruling applies to candidates for federal office, like Congress, Senate, President, not, as he said, for, say, a governor.
Exactly. The caller brought up a great point that the rules for federal elections are completely different than the rules for state elections. So this ruling only applies to these federal elections.
And then his second point was that, okay, we'll stop running ads that say vote for, vote against. We'll run an issue ad that says candidate X opposes this. Call candidate X and tell them they shouldn't oppose it. Never use the word vote. Does that give them wiggle room?
There's amazing creativity on the part of campaign donors. So one of the things, patterns that we've seen over the number of years is as soon as there's some rule that limits donor behavior is people will find a way around the system and that there's innovation to sort of skirt these rules. And so I don't know if the suggestion the caller's supplied would exactly work, but there's a lot of potential for creativity to sort of try to further skirt these rules.
Jay, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Steve with us in Sun Prairie. Steve, hello.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. One of the biggest contributions that is out there is an in-kind contribution that is made by the liberal media. So you look at CNN, which is, you know, if not 100% liberal, probably 98% liberal. Something should be done about that if you're going to tell other people that they can't have the same bully pulpit without risking their own livelihood. So I would prefer people be able to do what they want with their own money and get government out of it.
But you, what do you think of the disclosure idea in particular, Steve?
Like I said, I don't think people should care what private people do with their own money. Get government out of it.
All right, Steve, thanks for the call. Steve, it sounds like doesn't favor disclosure, and that's an argument that, the government shouldn't have anything to do with regulating that.
Yeah, he's certainly not alone in that. There are lots of folks who are sort of opposed to disclosure and think that they should be able to sort of advocate for causes they believe in and not have to pay any sort of potential political or commercial backlash for the popularity or unpopularity of those opinions.
Steve, thanks for the call. Nate joins us next in Milwaukee. Nate, hi.
Hi, thank you for having me. And I would suspect Steve is probably part of a vocal minority. Something that we actually had here in Wisconsin that was revealed by the John Doe 2 investigation into Scott Walker's recall campaign is that large amounts of money from small numbers of people were going to basically help out a political campaign, and it was there were sort of favors done after the election. And this is something that the voters had no idea of because it was hidden behind the third-party groups. And in theory, the politicians weren't supposed to know, so they couldn't give favors. But it was revealed that they absolutely did. So this is something that gets rid of one portion of bribery or one avenue of bribery. And it's also, in my mind, very hypocritical that you've got laws being put up against people protesting who are actual human beings by these same conservatives who run around and say, oh, you can't restrict money, which is, I think, an invitation to corruption ongoing.
Nate, thanks a lot for the call. And Nate's summing up one of the big arguments on disclosure is that if you don't know who's paying money to whom, you can't watch for potential influence on politicians.
Yes, he makes a great point. I mean, one of the biggest arguments in favor of sort of campaign finance rules more broadly and disclosure rules in particular is this idea of Justice Brandeis, that sunshine is the best disinfectant, that we need to sort of be able to see and understand what's happening so that we can understand that corruption or there's some sort of appearance of corruption in the process.
Thanks for that call, Nate. We're talking to Ellie Neff Powell from UW-Madison, looking at this U.S. Supreme Court decision not to block a court decision on disclosure of donations to this particular type of nonprofit political action group. So as you say, this isn't done yet. Who is the decider on what rules these groups are following now?
Well, there's a lot of ambiguity right now. And one of the biggest reasons for ambiguity is the Federal Election Commission has a bunch of vacant seats. So essentially, the Federal Election Commissioner is going to be the ones that are going to sort of provide the details about how this is going to be enforced and sort of what the process is going to be. But the sort of rules behind the Federal Election Commission, there are six seats, and you have to have four folks on the board to, in order to make any decision. Well, there are two empty seats right now. So it requires unanimity of the board to do anything. And right now, we've got gridlock. The Democrats and the Republicans on the Federal Election Commission can't agree on anything, and they can't get unanimity, so nothing is happening. So essentially, the Federal Election Commission just isn't doing anything in terms of rulings. And in this case, failure to sort of rewrite these rules meant that the disclosure was the sort of net result.
Does this lower court ruling spell out how this should work in the meantime, pending an FEC ruling?
It leaves a lot of ambiguity that the FEC is going to have to interpret, and we just don't know at this point how the FEC is going to handle this.
So lawyers at these nonprofit groups are going to be having some long sleepless nights here.
There are going to be a lot of lawyers doing a lot of research into exactly what this means and how this is going to change their behavior going forward.
And so it seems like one thing that might happen is a group decides to test this rule, not disclose something, wait for a court case and hope that it makes its way up the chain to the U.S. Supreme Court to get more clarification.
Yes. Or sort of refuse to disclose, get taken to court, but that inevitable court case is going to happen long after the election. And so, again, they can sort of drag out the system for the purposes of anonymity throughout this election cycle.
A lot to watch for there. Ellie, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Eleanor Neff Powell is an associate professor of political science at UW-Madison. We talked to her about the potential fallout from this U.S. Supreme Court decision to not block a lower court's ruling regarding so-called dark money. It requires nonprofit groups that place political ads to disclose donors' names, donors over $200. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll round up some of the top stories in Wisconsin news, including latest details now on the shooting yesterday in Middleton. In the midst of a Supreme Court nomination process, people are floating the idea of ending lifetime appointments to the nation's highest court, having some kind of term limit, one term of X number of years, 14, 18, different numbers are bouncing around. We'll hear the case to end lifetime appointments to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the blogger at The Smitten Kitchen gives us some great advice on slow roasting some of our favorite fall veggies. Yum, delicious vegetables on this week's edition of Food Friday. A sneak preview, I saw this, a surprising way to make sweet potatoes in the oven. I make sweet potatoes in the oven. We got a different way, a different recipe coming up. I'm a big fan of oven roasting vegetables. You will be too, I think, after you listen to Food Friday. That and more, it's all coming up tomorrow right here on Central Time.